content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the July 2024 Walter Magazine. We begin with the cover article, Off Kilter. In her paintings, Jen Matthews celebrates beauty in chaos by Colony Little. In the third floor studio of Jen Matthews' home, pop art paintings evoke colorful chaos. On one canvas, flowers fly from a geographic vase painted in vivid colors, as if an invisible hand has just tipped it off its pedestal. In another painting, a bouquet of limp, languid flowers belie the cheerfulness of their surrounding color palette. The work playfully chides society's relentless pursuit of perfection. I embrace the side of me that's a little messy and not perfect. By day, Matthews is the director of design at Raleigh creative agency Baldwin And. In her off hours, painting is a respite from life as a busy working mom of two teens, but her hobby has turned into a successful endeavor. Matthews was a creative child. She recalls using paint shop software on her parents' Commodore 64 to make greeting cards and flyers. "That's where my brain kind of clicked," she says. "You can do things on the computer and do art." As Matthews got older, design elements from popular advertising campaigns captivated her, and she started clipping magazine advertisements from brands like Esprit, Swatch, and Benetton that she saved in binders the way other kids would collect stamps or stickers. Matthews studied graphic design at North Carolina State University and landed her dream job in advertising as a designer and art director at McKinney in the early 2000s. She continued to work in advertising and marketing for over 20 years, painting in her spare time while building her career and growing her family. She drew and painted abstracted florals using oil pastels and acrylic paint. In other works, gestural lines appear to emerge from the canvas, as if she was peeling back layers of paint to reveal the bold shapes, patterns, and colors underneath. In these works, she built up layers of acrylic paint on the canvas. And if you look closely, you'll spot fragments of unexpected materials, like vintage fabrics, handmade paper, or pieces of string. She began posting her work on Instagram around 2018, selling pieces to followers who would reach out to her via direct message. During the pandemic, she transitioned to a four-day work week and found herself with time and space to paint more regularly and consistently. As terrible as 2020 was for a lot of people, I feel like it was sort of a cathartic time for me, she says. Work slowed down just enough for me to be able to really put some time into figuring out who I was as an artist. Her work gained a following on social media, and she started to take on commissioned work from clients who incorporated her paintings in their home decor. "When I was doing commissions, I made them feel very involved in the whole process because I do treat it like a design project," she says. Showing them progress through Photoshop on their walls, which gives them a sense of exactly what it's going to look like. She also began connecting with galleries like Art House in Charlotte and the Miller Gallery in Charleston, which now sell her works in limited releases online. She typically works on seasonal bodies of work that include 10 to 12 paintings at a time. Her latest release sold out within a week. Over time, Matthews' work has evolved beyond the layering of shape, color, and texture. She still focuses on abstract florals, but now the artist often incorporates small narrative vignettes in diptychs with cleverly constructed names. One example is a piece titled, I Got You, which features two teal and blue checkered vessels with interlocking handles. I did this one show and I overdid it. I was burnt out, she says, but my husband was there for me through and through. He was helping me frame things and he built a display for my work. That title is a nod to his arm around me while I'm falling apart. This year, Matthews has decided to scale back on commissions to focus on her seasonal batches of paintings. Through it all, painting helps her maintain her work-life balance. I see it as my chance to really play, she says. I like to make people smile and laugh and even scratch their heads a little. It's a time when I can challenge and express myself technically and conceptually, to lighten my mood with the hopes of brightening someone else's. This article was edited for Time. Next, Hanging in the Pines. The Duke Lemur Center leads the world in the research and protection of unique primates by Hampton Williams Hoffer. Nestled in the forest, 2 miles from Duke University's main campus, is the largest and most species-diverse lemur sanctuary on Earth. There, hanging in the North Carolina pines, hundreds of these curiously endearing primates also hang on to the edge of extinction. The Duke Lemur Center aims to save them. The rarity of lemurs is almost unbelievable. Millions of years ago, their ancestors rafted across the Mozambique Channel from mainland Africa, perhaps atop vegetation knocked loose by a cyclone, maybe even hibernating on the way, and arrived at an island where they had very few natural predators. While lemurs on the mainland went extinct, those on Madagascar blossomed. Isolated for 150 million years, they evolved uniquely, taking up almost every niche on the island. Today there are over 100 known species of lemurs, broadly defined as primates native to Madagascar and the nearby Comoro Islands, who are wide-eyed, wet-nosed, and long-tailed, ranging in size from that of a mouse to that of a small child. Lemurs are full of personality quirks and gentle in nature, and they vary greatly by species. There are the Sifakas, who hop on their back legs with their arms raised, and the crowned lemurs that live in the trees and have long noses and keen senses of smell. The mouse lemur has cartoonishly big eyes and tiny curled hands. Habitat loss now threatens nearly all species of lemurs, as some 90% of Madagascar's forest cover has fallen to human development. Climate change, poaching, and the illegal pet trade are factors, too. It's easy to see why someone would want a lemur as a pet, what with the soft fur and button noses. But that's problematic, even though it's legal in North Carolina. Lemurs are wild, social animals, requiring a lengthy period of maternal contact. And those raised by humans are often isolated, developmentally delayed, and riddled with psychological problems. The DLC is working to teach the public about these dynamic animals, to research them in order to better protect them in the wild, and to keep species alive through breeding. Their work takes place locally and on the ground in Madagascar. Our mission is to learn everything we can learn about lemurs, so we never know a world without them, says Sarah Soraya, the DLC's Director of Communications. The Duke Lemur Center started in 1966 as a collaboration between John Butner Janish, who was studying biochemical genetics in lemurs at Yale University, and Peter Klopfer, who was studying maternal behavior in mammals at Duke University. They dreamed up a primate facility in Duke Forest aimed at combining their research perspectives, a, quote, living laboratory, to explore the genetic foundation of primate behavior. Established initially on 80 acres, the center has expanded to 100 acres. Since its founding, the DLC has cared for and studied some 4,000 animals across 31 species of non-human primates, including lemurs, lorises, and tarsiers. Outside of their native Madagascar, more lemur species live here in the Triangle than anywhere else in the world. The Duke Lemur Center has collaborated for 35 years with conservation organizations and communities on the ground in Madagascar, seeing the place where these animals evolved and listening to cultural stories about lemurs. DLC employees have visited the zoos in Madagascar to help care for the animals, improving husbandry practices, and create new breeding programs there. DLC conservation technician Grayson Pellerito recently returned from a three-month stint in Madagascar, where she worked to support zookeepers at a facility near Tomasina on the eastern coast. Back in Durham, Pellerito's days include animal observation, cleaning, feeding, training, and enrichment. Depending on the day, she might be weighing animals or deep washing and rebranching their enclosures. I think most people would be shocked by how much work goes into this job, understanding not just each species, but the specifics about each individual is incredibly important to a healthy colony with superb animal welfare, says Pellerito. The high expectations for animal care at the Duke Lemur Center, she says, is why she loves her job. I know I can help give these animals the best life possible and work hard to keep them thriving. The work of the DLC goes far beyond housing the animals. They have a world-class education team, a research program, a devoted vet staff, primate technicians, and hordes of volunteers. Last year alone, 135 volunteers completed nearly 1,000 hours of service, along with student, staff, and corporate community groups that participated in service events. Many tend to a vast organic garden from which a recent batch of watermelon had the lemurs going wild. The nocturnal eyes chew a tiny hole in the melon and use their long middle fingers to scoop out the fruit, never cracking the rind. The non-invasive nature of the Duke Lemur Center's research also means that it's open to the public. Depending on species and weather, lemurs at the DLC live in large, multi-acre areas of natural forest, as well as in climate-controlled buildings with indoor and outdoor access. More than 35,000 visitors a year stop by to see fat-tailed dwarf lemurs nibbling on persimmons, ring-tailed lemurs swinging through the trees, or a newborn pair of black-and-white ruffled lemur twins. Guests can visit the tour path from May to September, or stop by the Lemur Landing gift shop year-round, with fees funding care and conservation initiatives. Other cities also boast great restaurants and basketball championships, but no other city has anything like the Duke Lemur Center, which is so incredibly unique to Durham, says Soraya. Thanks to the vigilant work of the DLC, generations to come will have the chance to know and study lemurs and follow in their paramount example of care and conservation. This article was edited for Time. From the Nature Department, a world inside a weed. This common pollinator plant has a unique structure and a host of insects to feed, by Mike Dunn. For a naturalist, an ideal summer day is one filled with wildflowers and butterflies. A group of plants that fits nicely into this idyllic scene are milkweeds. North Carolina has 17 species of native milkweeds that come in a beautiful range of colors, from pink to flame orange. They're best known as a host plant for the caterpillars of monarch butterflies, which lay eggs on the leaves as they pass through on their migration to and from central Mexico. But milkweeds are also great pollinator plants, attracting a wide variety of butterflies, native bees, and other beneficial insects. And they have some unique characteristics that make them particularly fascinating. Milkweed flowers typically occur in clusters, with all the flower stalks originating from one location, called an umbel. A close look at an individual milkweed flower shows just how unique it is. Its five petals are curved downward when fully open, which is similar to many other plants. But within the circle of petals, there are five hoods that together look like a crown perched on the top of a flower. That structure is aptly named a corona. Each hood contains copious amounts of nectar, beckoning pollinators to the all-important reproductive structure of the plant. Speaking of reproduction, another unique thing about this plant is its pollen, which instead of being the familiar powder-like grains, is fused into a sac called a pollinium. Two pollinium sacs are attached together like a saddlebag or a wishbone to form a structure called a pollinarium. Still with me? This is where it gets really strange. When an insect visits the flower, its leg may slip down into one of the slits between the flower's hoods and snag a pollinarium as it pulls its leg out. This is the flower's goal. As the insect moves to another flower, the wishbone arms of the pollinarium dry out, causing them to rotate, moving the structure into the proper position to be inserted into the receptive parts of the next milkweed flower. When that insect lands on another flower and its leg goes into a slit just right, the saddlebag breaks apart and deposits the pollen bags. As I've spent time watching pollinators like bumblebees on milkweed flowers, I've been able to observe these amber-colored saddlebags on its legs. If all this seems like a lot of effort on the part of both the flower and the pollinator, you may be right. Only a few flowers in each umbel will actually get pollinated and develop into mature seed pods. The seed pods vary in size and shape between the species, but all split along one side when they mature to release the seeds. The seeds have fluffy white tufts of hairs called comas, which help the seeds disperse in the wind. Many milkweeds also produce asexually through rhizomes, or underground stems that produce new shoots, which seems like a good idea for a species that has such a complicated pollination process. The name milkweed is derived from the milky sap that most species of this group contain in their leaves and stem, combined with the belief that certain species have been considered weedy in pastures and other managed landscapes. But many species of milkweed have also been prized for their practical value. One of the most interesting uses I've read about is that silky fibers attached to the seeds were used to fill life vests during World War II. While the name may have weed in it, these plants can be a great addition to any home landscape. Three of the more common species available in area nurseries are common milkweed, swamp milkweed, and butterfly weed. I have all three in a sunny area near our house. I fell in love with common milkweed while doing monarch larva monitoring for a citizen science project at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences Prairie Ridge Echo Station years ago. Common milkweed grows in dense stands of tall plants whose flowers have an incredibly sweet fragrance. It's a magnet for all sorts of pollinators and other critters and a favorite host plant of monarch butterflies. I was warned that it likes to spread if you plant it in your yard, and that has turned out to be very true. But it's easy to pull up wayward plants, and I find its beauty and wildlife value worth the effort. Swamp milkweed is a more delicate species that prefers to have wet feet, although it can thrive in a sunny spot with normal garden soil. It tends to be better behaved than its larger cousin and doesn't spread as much. The flowers are a beautiful light pink in color. The stem fibers are very strong and were used by many Native American tribes for cordage. Several bird species, such as yellow warblers, peel these fibers to use in nest construction. Butterfly weed is one of my favorite wildflowers. It's hardy, drought-tolerant, and blooms for a long time, adding a bright splash of color to any garden. The typical form has bright orange flowers, but varieties can also range from red to yellow-orange. It grows in a more compact, mound-shaped form to a height of 1 to 2 feet. Unlike most milkweeds, it doesn't have milky sap, but still contains the cardiac glycosides that make it unpalatable to most animals. I hope you can find space in your home landscape to plant a few of these wonderful native plants. The migrating monarch butterflies, as well as a host of other insects, will thank you. This article was edited for Time. From the endnote, Turning the Stone, a trio of cottages in Dorothea Dix Park start their next chapter by Anwani Clar. Diana Barefoot knows the gatekeeper's cottage inside and out. She lived here in what's now Dorothea Dix Park with her family from 1977 to 78 when her then husband, Glenn Withrow, was a medical officer at Dorothea Dix Hospital. Their daughter, Rebecca Withrow, remembers playing with her two siblings in the attic. "It's all so different now. Everything was woods," says Barefoot. "But they kept the latticework in the windows. I remember that detail." Her cottage, along with the superintendent's house and physician's house, are collectively known as the Stone Cottages. They were built in 1923 in the growth spurt after World War I and reflected the specialization of the staff for the expanding hospital, which was, at that time, a progressive mental health facility. In the 1990s, the Gatekeeper's Cottage, which was originally near the current intersection of Western Boulevard and South Boylan Avenue, was moved to join the other two residences. And for the past few years, architect David Moorer and his team at Moorer Architecture have been working with the Dix Park Conservancy with financial support from the State Employees Credit Union and the SECU Foundation to renovate these buildings to reflect the evolution of Dix Park. On June 1st, the three cottages were reopened for public use. The Stone Cottages now include a visitor center, offices for the Dix Park Conservancy and the City of Raleigh, a studio space for an artist in residence, and, perhaps most saliently to fans of the park and the adjoining greenway, public restrooms. The Stone Cottages will provide a much more welcoming entrance into the park to make it a place where people can really linger and enjoy themselves, says Janet Cowell, the CEO of Dix Park Conservancy. Each of the spaces has been meticulously preserved, from the woodwork to the moldings to the stone exteriors. The furnishings include conference tables by Raleigh Reclaimed, made from pecan trees that used to stand in the park. Inside the visitor center, an interactive exhibit traces the park's complicated history, from land used by Native Americans, to its days as a plantation, to its time as a psychiatric institution, and to the present day. Moorer, a longtime resident of nearby Boylan Heights, remembers jogging by the cottages 30 years ago. "I was always curious about the houses and hoped they'd get fixed up. It was a privilege and truly a team effort to turn these into cool spaces for things to happen," he said. General contractor Eric Brinker of the Northgate Group worked on the homes. "It's been a transformative project for Raleigh, and it looks just like we envisioned," Brinker says. "I'm proud to be part of the team creating this legacy for the park." Finally, looking through our date book calendar, Raleigh Little Theater's 2024 Teens on Stage and Teens Backstage Summer Program presents its grand finale, Our Town. Set in an idyllic, fictional New Hampshire town, the plot follows its citizens as they navigate their everyday life in the early 1900s. This 21st century adaptation consists of three acts: daily life, love and marriage, and death and eternity, incorporating culture and language from the present day. Tickets start at $16. The theater is located at 301 Pogue Street in Raleigh, and you can visit RaleighLittleTheater.org for more information. Our Town will run July 25th through August 4th. And the City of Raleigh's summer concert series returns to Fred Fletcher Park and Pullen Park. Bring a picnic and a blanket to enjoy local music and singing groups most Sunday evenings. On July 28th, jazz and swing group Tune Swingers Orchestra will be featured. The series will run through September, alternating between the parks. The concerts are free, and you can visit RaleighNC.gov for more information. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.